Welcome to the Contact Center Expert Show. This show is hosted by Nancy Monroe, CEO of Verbal Transactions, a voice enablement technology company. Join our discussion on how you can make your contact center a well-oiled machine.
All right. Woo. We are excited today.
Yes.
They're pumped. They are pumped.
Yep.
Because our guests, of course, you know. Well, all right, calm down, calm down. Sit down, ma'am. Sit down. You know, all right, don't rush the stage. All right. So today my guest is Murphy Frazier, and as a contact and customer experience consultant at Avtex, Murphy works within a specialized consulting practice focused on contact center optimization and strategy, where she helps organizations all shapes and sizes navigate their road to a mature contact center operation through technology and agnostic employee-centric lens. But prior to that, she was deeply ingrained in building customer support, contact, and CX foundations in the startup space. She's also a Skillshare and Eat Street alum, where she worked to support CX and customer success leadership roles. Her experience spans quality and performance management, voice of the customer, and voice of the employee program and customer engagement and retention social programs. So she, you may have seen Murphy, you know, before COVID. You know, you may have seen her at she's been recognized as ICMI's top 50 thought leaders and CloudCherry top 10 CX champion. She's also a proud member of the CX Accelerator community, where she serves as a channel leader for the global group of CX practitioners and allies. So welcome to our show today, and I'm so excited to talk to you about this topic, which I think is near and dear to every single contact center, every single company out there, is the cost of a bad hire. And so let me first ask you, when did this become something you were drawn to?
Great question, Nancy. And first, thanks so much for having me. Exciting to be talking about this. You know, one of the things that as a people manager, as an employee myself, especially within the contact center, you hear, you know, ooh, we thought we got a good one, but that just, that didn't work out. That was a bad hire. And over the course of my time as a leader and someone in the contact center space, CX as well, you come to kind of think, what is really the root cause here? And I'm inclined to believe and to feel that actually thinking of a bad hire is kind of a lazy approach. It's a little bit of lazy language, right? It really puts the onus on the employee that we perceive to be that bad hire without really critically evaluating the systems, the culture, the training environment and experience that they are brought into, all of those pieces that really at the end of the day perhaps are the reason that we perceive that employee to be a bad hire. And I want to preface and say, you know, we know as well that there is, you know, sometimes we just get it wrong. It's not a great fit on both sides. There are clear and obvious things that are reasonable to understand. But I want us to dig in a little bit and kind of challenge that notion that it's not just all about that person or that employee. There's often a lot of underlying things to explore.
No, I completely agree with you, and I'll tell you why. So I had a prior business where I created a role-playing simulator. And I was acquired by one of my biggest customers, and I said, you know, why aren't you using this role-playing simulator in a pre-screening process? Because once you get hired, that it's what you are using to teach people how to talk on the phone. So why aren't you using this as a one way to screen people? And so what happened was, I would say their turnover rate was probably 25%. And so, you know, we were constantly, you know, trying to fill that bucket of potential candidates. And so once I started using the simulator, two things happened. One would be either, you know, I would tell them, follow the script word for word. Don't try to get cute. Don't get creative. And sure enough, somebody thinks, I'll look better if I do this. So I would immediately eliminate them because they don't follow directions. So that was one measurement stick. But the other one was some people just wouldn't do it. And so rather than, you know, they had a good interview and just base it on that and their resume, this, again, was another way to kind of eliminate somebody that we may have hired and turned out to not be a good fit. So it's so I'm curious to hear some of the ways that you've kind of analyzed that process or that stage gate process of bringing in a new hire.
Yeah, that's interesting, right? How do we test for some of those behavioral-based components? It's so critical, really, in contact work in particular, right? You know, 9 times out of 10, this isn't always true, but 9 times out of 10, you can train for the tool, right, or the, the technical navigation of the system, application, what have you. But it's that ability to bring in emotional intelligence and situational awareness and things of that nature that I think we often miss, that again trickles down into us feeling like, ooh, you know, we missed the mark here. So I would even, though, take a step back and say, you know, it's what happens before we get to the interview or the screening, right? Have contact center leaders developed relationships with recruiting teams that are rock solid, such that those folks really understand what we're needing, what we're looking for, and the type of person that is going to be successful in this role. And then also, you know, are we setting really clear and realistic expectations up front about what the work actually is? Because I'll tell you a funny story, you know, and I'm sure lots of contact center folks can relate to this, but it took me a while earlier on in my career to actually realize that I was working in a contact center, right? I thought, oh, this is great. I'm going to answer phones and send emails and maybe do some live chats and all of a sudden, as you know, a year went on and I was like, oh, I'm in a leadership role, I'm a supervisor now, I'm supervising a contact center, I'm not just you know, talking to customers. So it's contact center work is not for everyone, right? I think we can all agree on that. It's a special kind of work. It's amazing when you find someone who really loves it, but if we're not setting really crisp and clear expectations about what the job is, the levels of emotional labor involved is also something that's often missed, right? We're talking to customers often when they're angry, when they're upset. And if we're not being clear about that early and up front, we're setting that employee up to already be at a little bit of a disadvantage. So that's kind of an initial point, even before we get to that interview process in and of itself.
But yeah, I like that because there's other things, too, to think about. Let's say the compensation you're able to offer, you know, the benefits that, you know, the package, shall we say, the package that you're offering. The culture, you know, are you looking for somebody that's comfortable in a, you know, maybe it's a lot of male-dominated, you know, maybe it's a technical type of product, and unfortunately there's a lot of women that may not be drawn to that field, or they are, just haven't been given the opportunity. So, you know, are you comfortable with that? So there's all these other factors, like you said, before, you know, even, you know, screening a resume that go into how successful is that person going to be that we bring on board and the things that you do that impact it.
Absolutely. And I love that you make that call out because it's so true. You know, over the history of contact center time, let's say, right, we imagine just these dark, big rooms full of cubicles or desk stations, right? And it's not always traditionally or typically seen as a collaborative environment, open, light, airy, where there's a lot of, you know, opportunities for engagement with peers, kind of have this stigma, right, of just being stuck to the phone or stuck in your desk. So we have to challenge that. We have to make sure we're creating safe spaces for anybody who comes to join that is perhaps not part of our normal environment from a diversity perspective, from an ability perspective. We really do absolutely have to be honest with ourselves about where we're falling short there and then be honest with candidates as well. I will say the one other thing that really stands out to me that I see a lot now in consulting work in particular is performance expectations, not clearly, again, up front and early, setting the stage for what folks can expect to be evaluated against, how their success will be measured, what the business is really looking for, right? You're here to do a thing, but mm-hmm. what is the output that is expected of you? And I, unfortunately, you know, we see it a lot. Employees that don't learn of those things until they're out of training, maybe already, you know, feeling a little uneasy about their path forward and their ability to be successful. And that can really be mitigated by just better upfront communication, transparency, and aligning with the employee as to whether or not they feel reasonable, right? This is a two-way street. We have to make sure it works for both sides.
Mm. Yeah, I love that you say that, because one of the things that we learned early on, so we have this call center simulator, so we can emulate any inbound, outbound, chat, voice. So it's all a standalone mm-hmm. system that you can practice. And one of the things I learned early on was, oh, well, you know, if you're on a live call, you've got this QA checklist that somebody's holding you accountable for on those calls.
Sure.
So I asked the client, I said, can I have your checklist? Why aren't we measuring them against the exact same things that they're being measured on in a live call in the simulator? Because we have that. There's no other training tool out there that has that functionality. So I can build in little cues or markers or things that I'm tagging in the background mm-hmm. and scoring them on in an automated way in the training program. And it lets them know right away, just like you said, what are they being held accountable for? This is what, if you're on a live call, this is exactly how you would have scored on a live call, you know, so they know exactly where they stand from, you know, did you express empathy correctly? Did you say yes and had a positive, you know, language about it? Did you solve the problem? Mm-hmm. You know, all these things that if I'm a QA analyst sitting there right there and listening on the phone or listening to the recording, you know, this is how they're being measured. So it makes perfect sense to me to say, so every client we work with now is like, first thing, I want to see your QA checklist, because we're going to reverse engineer it into that simulator.
Yeah.
So those agents know exactly what they're being held accountable for.
Absolutely, yeah. Such a crucial point. And also, you know, this is probably a point for a whole different conversation, but I'll call it out and say, too, from an operational leadership perspective, are the metrics that you're holding your employees accountable to sensical, right? Are they realistic? Are they reasonable? Do the agents responsible for meeting that goals have the tools, the training, the tech, the people management, the coaching, all of those things necessary in order to actually achieve what's desired? And that's another piece, too, that's often overlooked, right? Sometimes we have these performance metrics and expectations that actually are in direct conflict with good agent behavior or good contact handling. And that can really put folks in a tough spot, right? You feel like you really want to work to be there for the customer, but then you have these, you know, really specific average handle time targets, things like that, that are, again, working in direct conflict, starting to make you perhaps feel a little worn out, like, again, this wasn't what I thought I was getting in or signing up for.
Right.
And now my performance is suffering, and we're starting to sow those seeds for maybe Murphy was a bad hire. Maybe this wasn't quite what we were looking for.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's funny. I did a blog post about 3 or 4 months ago because of a conversation I had with somebody about, you know, if you're hiring, you know, remote workers, and if you're going to continue to have remote workers, the manager tended to be the first line of tech support. And so it's like,
oh goodness,
now are you looking at how tech savvy the person is, because they've got to make sure their computer is set up right, or they've got all these things in their home office that you can't bring an IT person in for, and is that impacting, you know, how you're looking at someone in their ability to work or be efficient because they have to be more technical than maybe in the past?
Oh, my gosh. Yes, this is a huge one, too, especially, again, kind of seeing what we're seeing right now is, you know, folks are had to pivot, had to adjust, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's many contact centers in particular that thought there was never a possibility to go remote, right? That just wasn't reasonable or realistic. We've learned now, of course, and we probably should have known this before, it absolutely is, but you're 100% right. Are we penalizing an employee for struggling with their setup? Are we not sending them what they need far enough of advance of their new start date so that they are ready to go and feeling like they're set up for success. And then if they do have a problem, are we penalizing them for that, right? Are we my kind of least favorite thing I see sometimes is tagging it as unproductive time, right? I, as an agent, I've hit a snag, and now I have to go into this unproductive state while I get support or get help, and it's not my fault, right? I'm really trying to get back up and running, but again, these metrics that we sometimes put in place are hindering my ability to feel like I have the support of my manager, my team, and the organization as a whole, right? Because we haven't perhaps thought really intentionally about how to set folks up for success again in these new environments.
Yeah, and it's it does. I think it does have an impact. But I guess the one good thing about remote workers is that you're not locked into a geographic territory. I mean, that's some of the other things. There's a I had another guest on the show last year, and he goes out to rural communities, and he finds that he gets a very loyal employee base, and they pull in their relatives because they don't really have many options for jobs. You know, they don't have to travel an hour or one way to, so they become very loyal, and then it becomes where they may have been servicing a customer now for 10 years. Because there's no turnover because there's nowhere to go. But now you can hire people all over the place, you know, so that those geographic restrictions are gone. So I don't know if you've seen any examples of where that's played out, good or bad.
Yeah, absolutely. Have certainly seen it and agreed that it's an equalizer to a certain degree, certainly not in a total capacity, but it does extend opportunities for folks that perhaps were otherwise not going to be considered. And of course, there are great people out there. So a point, though, that sits with me perhaps, you know, in a unique capacity, if you will, is how do we make sure that we're starting to get into culture here now, right? We're starting to understand how do we create a remote environment that has adapted to the kind of culture, hopefully good, right, that we had in the office. How do we make sure that if we are absorbing kind of a hybrid model where we have some remote, some in office, whether it's all remote, all in office, all of these pieces come into play to say what helps folks be successful there. First and foremost is making sure that there's strong cultural foundation, and especially for a new hire, right? I actually, I onboarded in a previous role fully remote, and I feel like I had a good experience, but you have to work a little bit harder, and I've also done the same. I've hired people in a remote capacity, and it's so critical that we work a little bit harder, we over-communicate and over-extend opportunities for cultural engagement, because, again, when you start to kind of tie it back to the bad hire thing here, we start to see it break down a little bit when we're feeling like, okay, I'm new, I'm onboarding in a remote environment, I'm onboarding into an environment that has these high expectations, high demand, and if I'm not feeling immediately connected or aligned to that culture, then I'm already kind of, it's starting to crumble.
So, no kidding.
A key thing to keep in mind,
Have you seen examples of how a call center helps that person learn the culture from a remote location?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of different ways to do it, and certainly have seen different examples of this. It comes down, again, I think, to overextending early on, so really making that initial interview, recruiting, onboarding, and training experience as engaging as possible, and not sticking folks in front of a computer, you know, just a training video or a single source of video content, something that is completely not really doing much to get them ingrained. But there are, you know, some fun tools and resources out there to kind of create these virtual meeting spaces where you kind of put together a virtual environment for folks to come in and engage with one another, getting folks early access to their leaders, their managers, and really starting to cultivate the relationship before you start to dig into the training and really starting to create that nesting period, if you will, where everyone's aligned on what's happening and moving forward. There's so many different ways to do it. It's still, I think, so important to call out that we're still learning. I'm not sure we have that perfect experience or solution hammered out yet for welcoming contact center folks into a remote environment, but any opportunities for collaboration and getting folks excited and engaged in the work up front and early and creating safe spaces to do so is key.
Yeah. Where I was just at, where was I? Oh, I was up in Galena, Illinois for a little family getaway, and one of the people along with us, her said, oh, my boss lives in Galena, but she's gone this week, so I've never met her.
Oh, darn.
This has been the first time you could have actually met face-to-face, you know, because the restrictions have been lowered, but it was just like, oh, no, you know, so I'm, you know, it could be maybe they, at least people that are geographically close, maybe they could meet once in a while. I've seen people where they send like a little welcoming package where it's like a mug and a T-shirt and things like that, you know. I've seen where they deliver like Uber Eats, you know, like say you're doing a lunch and learning, you actually get lunch delivered to your home office.
All great ideas. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, it's actually funny you brought up the meeting with someone who you'd love to have, you know, this example of having the opportunity to connect in person. One thing I will say that has been continuing to surprise me is how many organizations are actually not leaning on the collaboration tools that they have at their disposal today. Mm-hmm. Often as a result of kind of scrambling to get folks set up in their remote environments, not really thinking long-term, right, about the kind of tools or tech that might be helpful to facilitate that one-on-one personal connection. And, you know, I see it more than I wish I did, right? We're not leveraging video. Of course, you know, there should be an option there, but we're not using what we have because we're still in so many cases, especially now as we're navigating a return in many regards. To invest in making sure that we're using what we have.
Yeah, one thing I've heard that was, I think, a bad example was somebody was talking about where they had a video monitor on them at all times. And I'm like, what about if there's children in the home, privacy concerns, you know? And I'm just like, if you can't trust your employees without having a camera on them the full time they're working. I mean, that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
So that's a bad example.
that is a really bad example. I would struggle with that. I think there's got to perhaps be some, you know, compliance concerns there as well. And at the end of the day, that's actually a really perfect example of the culture of that organization, right? It lacks trust. There's certainly a component of micromanagement and feeling like we have to have eyes on folks at all times to ensure that they're doing exactly what they should be. And we're forgetting that I forget the exact wording of this saying now. It's not just that we're working from home, right? Home is our work now in many regards.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're doing things like that, you're completely inhibiting an employee from having a boundary in their personal space, in their personal environment. And that is, quite frankly, toxic. And I hate to say this on a recorded line, but I'm sure that that organization is seeing some turnover as those practices continue.
That's pretty bad. But you're right about the collaboration thing. And I think part of it is that I introduced OneDrive to this last company that acquired my previous business. And I said, all right, you know, you're all using Microsoft. You're all, you know, on Windows. I would highly recommend that everybody start using OneDrive. And so I had to teach people how to, you know, how to put your files in OneDrive. It's not that hard. You're all working. But the people that didn't do it were the executives. And I get this panic phone call one day.
Right?
Right, exactly. So the CEO calls me in a panic one day and says, "Did you have a backup of my laptop?" I'm like, "Well, did you put everything in OneDrive?" He's like, "No." I'm like, "Then no."
Oh, gosh.
I'm like, "It's not like this automatic thing because you're on the network, you get backed up."
Yeah.
And I'm just like, but it's culture and teaching people and supporting the technology and learn, lead by example, you know, getting the CEO to maybe IM people and things like that. So that might be a way to, you know, leverage those collaboration tools is from the very top.
Right. And, you know, it's a cliche, right? But that mm-hmm. lead by example point is critical. How, you know, as an agent, let's say I'm struggling to adapt and adopt. And if I see that my manager even, we don't even have to climb all the way up to the executive level,
mm-hmm.
but if I'm being asked
mm-hmm.
to do things or follow processes that not even my direct supervisor, leader, manager is doing, it might not feel immediately like that breakdown of trust, alignment, and buying in it is occurring, but it absolutely is, and it's starting
mm-hmm.
to poison the well, right? If I'm starting to feel like I'm held to something that other folks that I work alongside or work with are not doing, then why should I do it?
Mm-hmm.
And then it all starts
yeah.
to slide from there.
Yep, it does. You know, I've seen people that not use, like somebody has their own spreadsheet of, you know, like their sales or whatever, they're not putting it in the CRM, you know, because they're like, well,
I don't
want my boss to see it yet, you know, but I'm keeping track
of
it, you know, or the manager's keeping track of it. You know, and tells people, don't put your numbers in there yet till X, Y, and Z. You know, and just like, no.
Security risk. Oh, goodness. So many red flags for that one.
Exactly.
You know, I will say, too, though, Nancy, the other side of that, too, is kind of the inverse flip, which is organizations reacting so quickly and trying to
mm-hmm.
throw a lot of different tools, tech, processes at the quote-unquote problem, right, to make it better, to make it easier, to make it more fun,
mm-hmm.
without
mm-hmm.
aligning those activities back to a strategic goal or output, right? We can add, you know, we can go and say we need to start saving everything to OneDrive, but we also want you to do things here, and we also, you know, this
mm-hmm.
executive needs to see things
mm-hmm.
here. So now you've created
yeah.
this ecosystem
You're right.
of I have so many different places to do different things, and I'm frazzled, I'm overwhelmed, and really it just results in no adoption at all.
Yep, 100%. Yep, that's exactly, and I've seen it happen so many times, and you know, when SharePoint was, like, real big, you know, people weren't, they weren't, IT departments weren't allowing people to use SharePoint for certain things, even because I said, well, you know, they'd ask me to do X, Y, and Z or build something. I said, well, you have SharePoint, right? Yeah. Well, why aren't you putting in SharePoint? Well, we got to submit this, and then we got to,
it all ties back to how we operate. There's absolutely a cultural component, and, you know, it sounds in that instance especially, we're working in a lot of silos. And
mm-hmm.
that is one of the hardest things to challenge and to break in organizations, I think, especially in contact center environments. But that, oh, Nancy, we could have a whole other,
a
whole other chat on contact
center silence. Yeah. Now, I'm curious, are there any, like, personality assessments or tools that you've used that help kind of define, you know, how to align someone to a certain team within the call center that you've used or that you've seen that works well?
Yeah, you know, this is an interesting question. Sometimes I'm hesitant to put upfront effort in having folks complete some of those activities before they're hired because we're adding
mm-hmm.
a lot of extra layers to the process. The reason I say that is this is particularly pervasive in startup culture. I'm sure it's present in
mm-hmm.
other organizations as well, but we like to send exercises to people to essentially,
yes.
like, for example, solve a business problem that we're facing, and let's see if the candidate can figure it out for us, and
yes.
it gets
yep.
a little tricky there. I think, you know,
yep.
more broadly, and this is it's a big question, but behavioral-based interviewing, right? Let's do some role-playing.
Mm-hmm.
Let's do some scenario-based questions here that really kind of helps me understand I'm not looking for a right answer here. I'm looking to understand kind of what we were talking about earlier, how you respond. How do you approach the problem? How do you engage with me? And I've found those to be very helpful. And continuously reinforcing those is important throughout the process, especially, you know, not perhaps in contact centers where maybe you're not going through an 8-round interview, but bringing those back into the training environment, of course, is critical. And then, you know, I do like to once someone is hired and on the team, do some of those assessments. Enneagram is a fun one to help understand, you know, how you think, how you work, and how you approach things.
Okay.
The classics as well, like Myers-Briggs and things of that nature are fun. StrengthsFinder is another good one.
Yep.
But largely, I'll say I think those are best to come once you've been hired.
That's awesome advice, and I think our audience will agree with that. I like that. I like waiting till after they're on board, because you get to know them just a little bit better too with more one-on-one time with them.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Oh, my goodness.
You also, I'll throw it in there.
Yeah.
You don't want to introduce biases too early, and I think some of those personality tests can yield those, so that's important to think. But this was so fun. I appreciate you having me, and thank you for this. This was great. Good energy for the rest of the day ahead.
And I'm sure our listeners have learned a lot, and we'll have to have you on again in the future.
Great. I'd love that. Thank you so much, Nancy.
Okay. Thanks,
Murphy. Thanks, everyone,
Bye.
For listening.
Yep.
Bye-bye.
Bye.